welcome to this COVID-19 edition of Rational Radio in our virtual studio. Gigi Alcock, David Shapiro. We've got lots coming up with Paul O'Sullivan joining us from London. Who knows how he got there? And we'll also be talking to the man who's going to make respirators for South Africa. I'm Alec Hogg. Let's pick up with David Shapiro first. David, the markets themselves, let's just go back a little bit. In the last 2 weeks, Wall Street has had its best fortnight in 80 years. Share prices up 15%. The year as a whole, the share prices are only down by 10% when you take the Dow Jones Industrial Average. If you take the tech stocks, the NASDAQ, they're only down by 4% on the year. It's been an incredible recovery, shortest ever bear market. What are you making of this?
We're only halfway there. You know, if we really measure how far markets did fall, they were down about, 30%. So we've recovered half. The second half is going to be difficult. And I think that's what we have to watch. The news that's coming through is slightly better. You know, in the US, we're starting to see the death count diminish, particularly in New York. Not as much pressure as there was on hospital beds. In Europe, we're seeing Spain, Italy, France, report, better or a slowdown in the number of incidences, and Germany's return to work. So it's difficult, Alec. We're slowly getting there, but I still think there's a lot ahead of us in terms of whether the consumers will come out spending and feel that there's a proper recovery on the way. So I'm thrilled at where we are at the moment, but I think you've got to be very careful about how we tread from now on.
Well, we're going to pick up in more detail on that side of the economy as well. But Gigi Alcock, when we spoke 2 weeks ago, was already starting to see signs of stress in the informal economy in South Africa. We've had 2 week longer lockdown, with that being extended as well to be 5 weeks overall. We see some quite disturbing pictures on our television screens.
Hi, Alec. I think that there's going to be quite a lot more of those disturbing images. A while ago, I said quite controversially that the informal sector, if the employment generated by the informal sector was considered, the real rate of unemployment was closer to 12%. And I think we're seeing that now, because the reality is that there are large portions of our population who are being sustained informal incomes, either their own small businesses or being employed by informal businesses. And we're seeing quite an impact on that. In Alex last week, there was a demonstration, and one of the ladies was interviewed on ENCA, and she said, "I don't want food parcels. I want to be able to start my business again and feed myself." And I think there's this widespread, and I think there's kind of two components to that. The one is that people are going to be looting and demonstrating, and on the other hand, as I said, 2 weeks ago, there's going to be a lot of those businesses are just going to just start going back to work. And we saw that in last week in Tembisa. I've got photos of salons that started opening up again behind closed doors. Ashisanyama started operating, and the reality is that people cannot. You know, what is an essential service? If you have no other form of income, if you a small business that cannot access the UIF benefits or any of the other benefits, which to a large extent the informal sector can't access any of the benefits and interventions that have been put in place, the reality is that you're facing starvation. And so people will either loot or they will start going back to work. And it's quite dire out there, you know. I mean, we make all the jokes about people desperately wanting alcohol and cigarettes. Imagine the desire for a glass of wine, but now it's for putting food on the table, full stop. And I think that one of our interventions has to be about, first of all, what are we doing about those now? And the second has to be about, what about the day after? Because I think that to a large extent, we're trapped at the moment and looking at lockdown as it is. And the real thing has to be, and I think the government's been remiss on this in terms of saying, the day after lockdown ends, how are we going to address that issue? Because that's really going to be the big thing on the agenda.
And of course, just to complicate everything, the science is now very inconclusive. On Friday, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who's a professor of medicine at Stanford University, that's where, if you might recall, Steve Jobs gave his very famous commencement speech. It's often rated the best business school and the best university in the United States. He's also a fellow of the Economics Institute. So it's a most unusual guy, professor of medicine and an economist. And his videos have gone viral where he has been questioning the whole basis for the lockdowns. And where he comes from is he says that the denominator, in other words, the number of people who've been tested, is far, far too small. And then on Friday, the Stanford University published a research that they'd done in their local county, and they've made it as representative as possible, given higher weighting to poorer people. And there they show that the actual mortality rate is something like 50 to 85 times lower than the concerns that we had. So you just overlay all of that and you start wondering, well, have we got another Y2K issue that's happened here where everybody panicked and actually the result was a lot different. David, what are you making of all of this confusing noise?
It's exactly confusing noise. What's astonishing is that there's not one government that has a coherent plan or is really well equipped. And please correct me if I'm wrong, if you can establish one country that has handled this correctly. But I think that's the problem. No one knows what to do. And I think if you listen to Gigi, it's, we just locked down an economy, not realizing how extensive supply chains are and how many people are hurt along the way. And we just assume that once we reopen, everything's just going to fall into place. It's not going to happen. I think the damage is extensive. So, when I say we have to take this literally one step at a time, we're not quite sure how we're going to get out of this. I'm thrilled at the way that markets are responding in the sense that we haven't seen another collapse, but I still think there are a lot of questions ahead. And worst of all is we don't understand the virus. No one's really got on top of it and understands it. The only good thing is that we are getting more hospital beds, and the health authorities have seemed to be getting, or hopefully getting, on top of that. I'm talking from a global perspective, not from a South African perspective. But Alec, every one of these arguments is relevant. We can't dismiss them, and we've got to work out which course we take. I don't know which course is going to be taken.
Gigi, let's just assume that Dr. Bhattacharya is right, that the mortality rate of COVID-19 is more akin to the normal flu season mortality rate, i.e. 0.1%, rather than the 1% or 10 times higher that has been propagated by certain people, including his country's Dr. Fauci, who's been saying that's the reason why we have to keep lockdowns, etc. If from what you see within the townships, where presumably people are it's not that easy for people to social isolate, etc. Also from what we see in the more formal sector, that the hospitals in South Africa have certainly not been overrun by COVID-19 cases, not even close to it, then maybe there is an argument to be had for readdressing or rethinking the whole approach that we're taking economically wise.
Look, I think, Alec, the problem is that in Africa you can't apply the same solutions that you're applying in Europe or America in terms of locking down. So, one of the articles I wrote, I said, why don't we, a large proportion of the township economy is basically in the residential areas. It's not like you've got a business area and stuff. So should we not look at actually, if we are going to have a lockdown, doing it street by street rather than trying to get people to stay inside their shack or their yard, which is clearly not happening. I mean, we're seeing that people are much better. I've got someone went down into the rural area, Msinga, where I grew up, and took some visuals with a drone. And most people are sitting in their yards and very little traffic out. I mean, people still walk to the river to fetch water and so on and so forth. But people are adhering to it to a large extent. And in the rural areas, people are kind of staying within their little community as opposed to just inside their houses. And I think that we need to look at that differently, and we need to look at it differently from an economic perspective, because if we open up that you can operate within your street or certain businesses with, whatever distancing measures you need and sanitizer and so on. But at the end of the day, surely it is a far better thing to make it, a law that you have to wear a mask if you go out and that you can only operate in your street, because it'll allow, first of all, practical way of ensuring people don't mingle. And second of all, it will allow for some form of economic activity to happen. And the reality is that is how it's happening at the moment. Someone shared a visual of Diepsloot the other day. And of course, the police van drives down the road and everyone pops into their shack and the police van disappears and everyone pops out and starts chatting again. So let's look at reality. We are not going to close down, and all that happens is that the police and the army get more, tougher on people, and there's all these incidents we're hearing about. And apartheid, with all the military and emergency measures and whatever it might be, could not keep people from engaging in shebeens or selling veggies in the street and so on and so forth. We have to look at this on a different level, and I think we can't ignore the danger, but on the other hand, we have to balance it with reality, with a large dose of reality and what's practically possible.
Paul O'Sullivan joins us now. Gigi, actually a nice segue from when you talk about things closing down. Paul's been very outspoken about the closing down of South African Airways. The piece that you wrote last week that we published on BizNews, Paul, you were pretty vociferous about what has happened at South African Airways and saying that we shouldn't kill it, or the country should not kill it, because of the corruption that the Zuptoid put forward, and in particular the former chairman, Dudu Mnyeni. Have you had much response to that?
Yes, Alec, I've had a lot of response. And I anticipated some of it. Everybody's of, not everybody, a lot of people are in favor of keeping the airline. A lot of people think it's a drain on resources and it should go. But I think some of it's quite short-sighted. They don't realize the cost of liquidating that airline.
Now, I think there's a cabinet meeting today at which these, or there'll be a follow-up, but presumably we believe there was a cabinet meeting last week at which the Minister of Public Enterprises, Pravin Gordhan, who comes in for quite a lot of stick in your piece, actually did propose the closing down of the airline.
Well, obviously, I'm not privy to what's going on at Cabinet. I don't think anybody is, other than the Cabinet members themselves. But clearly, it's not as clear-cut as people think. You can't just shut a national airline. Now, they reckon for somewhere between 40 and 50% of the income of AXA. They bring tourists into the country from long-haul destinations, and those destinations are very important to South Africa. The tourism industry itself, the hospitality industry, accounts for millions of jobs, and there's virtually no competition in the long-haul market if South African Airways are closed down. So people will be able to fly from America, the UK, and all other destinations, but there'll be no competition, so the prices will go up. And the effect of that will be a reduced number of tourists.
You did tackle Pravin Gordhan in July 2016 on the whole issue of the way South African Airways was being managed at that point. Just take us through that interaction.
Well, Dudu Mnyeni was still the chairman of South African Airways at that stage, and I asked Pravin Gordhan straight up, when is he going to deal with the corruption that's taking place at South African Airways? And I was particularly concerned about Dudu Mnyeni. And he made a statement that South African Airways would be dealt with the introduction of board members. But the problem is he kept Dudu Mnyeni in place for a further 16 months to finish off what started and clear off out the back door without as much as any sanctions whatsoever being applied to her. And 16 months, you can wreak a lot of damage in that time, and she did.
Was it politically possible, though, for him to do anything about it?
Okay, if one looked at what happened at the Sondo Commission, Pravin was very outspoken about how his hands were tied and this was going on and that was going on. What he singularly failed to do was to go and open a criminal docket. Act 12 of 2004, which is the anti-corruption legislation, makes it clear that if you're in a position where you know there's corruption going on, you're obliged to report it to the authorities. That did happen.
David Shapiro, come in here for a minute. Pravin Gordhan is a little bit of a, almost like a saint in many ways in South Africa. And here we've got somebody saying that he actually needs to be called to account.
To an extent, I agree with Paul. I made a comment last week just on TV about where we used to be with SAA. You know, it had an enormously good brand in Africa, not only in Africa, but in the world. It was a top airline. We had the best pilots. Not only that, we were known for our technical excellence. And the big concern, as Paul correctly says, you know, there's an ecosystem around every little business. Even a mine shaft has businesses around the mine shaft that rely on it, from schools to doctors and so on. And if you consider what this means for SAA, you know, for AXA, for all the other businesses that are associated with bringing tourists in or seeing through, you know, seeing traffic, that has to be replaced. We can't let it go. So who's going to come in? You know, who's going to come in and fill the gap that exists? There has to be a way around this, but to a large extent, this has been our own, our own making. You know, we've scored a lot of goals, and one has to also now work out what's the cost. What can we do to resurrect it? I mean, UK to, you know, those routes, the London routes, the New York routes, the other routes are there, can't just be given away. And also the domestic routes, Cape Town, Durban, and so on. So I'm a bit surprised that they're just going to close it down and just, you know, sack 9,000 odd individuals. And with that comes another 2,000 that are going to lose their jobs because of that, from catering to everything. So there has to be a plan B other than just simply closing it down.
Is there, Paul? Is there any plan B that looks possible?
Well, there's no doubt that the airline as it currently stands needs to be fully restructured. And that restructuring process needs to take account of the fact that routes, for example, like Johannesburg, London, are one of the most lucrative airline routes in the world. There are other routes that have, for example, Germany, Paris. These are very lucrative routes. So maybe what they need to do, and I, you know, it's not my job to dictate what should happen, but the logical thing to do is to can all the loss-making routes and just, you know, bring this, pair it back to an airline that's only focused on delivering good service on the lucrative routes, the money-making routes. And if that means they have to lay off some equipment, then they should lay off the equipment. If it means they have to lay off some staff, unfortunately, those staff will have to be laid off. But that surely has to be far better than liquidating a company that will have a devastating effect on the economy of the country.
Gigi, I'd love to get your take on this, given that you're so close to the informal sector and that the argument has been SAA only benefits rich people, so let's get rid of it.
I think to a certain level it does benefit the rich in terms of flying on there, but I think we have to look at the ecosystem. I'm a really big believer in the fact that we have to look at the total economic ecosystem. So, you know, even from the informal sector perspective, the person who earns their income from SAA goes home and buys a quarter or goes to a Shisanyama and so on in the township and gets their hair done at the hair salon and so on and so forth. I think that the ripple effects are far beyond just the formerly employed people who may get retrenched. It's really about how does that travel through the entire system. Also, from a kind of informal sector perspective, to a large extent, you're talking communities. So, you know, people who are employed in a community serve a very powerful function within those township communities. So, yeah, my feeling would be that we need to measure the impact much more than just those employed, much more than those jobs that would be lost. It's the trickle through to the rest of the economy. And, you know, rather reduce salaries rather than remove them completely.
David, it does appear as though things are very complex in this world of ours today, and sometimes we lose sight of that. Retrench 9,000 people, shutter SAA, and the problem will go away. But you might have a multiplier effect, which is very negative.
It's exactly that. Immediately what comes to mind is Bitvest. You know, Bitvest does services all the aircraft, buses the people to the, you know, to the various aircraft, and someone will fill that gap. It'll be EBA, it'll be Virgin, it'll be Etihad, it'll be all of those companies will come in and double their liners, and the profits will not flow to the country, will flow obviously outside. Of course, they will create jobs there, but this is people will travel, Alec. We're going to go back to it. You know, it's not maybe a month or two, we'll be a bit cautious and we'll change some of the health regulations and hygiene regulations, but they will travel, and someone's going to come in and fill the gap with flying down to Durban. It might be Comair or so on. And I think that there's got to be some kind of plan devised that's going to, either privatize SAA in a different kind of way, but something has to be done. But these are the supply chains that we don't understand. You know, these are the supply chains that actually drive the global economy. And even on the informal sector, just think of the chaps. Just think of the number of taxi drivers. Just think of the people who wheel your baggage. You know, even there might be a few and they control. There are many, many people, the chaps who run the airport, you know, the various shops and so on. So someone will fill the gap. But, you know, we've got to consider that. We've got to take that into account. We can't just close it down.
Paul, getting back to that very hard-hitting article, I know there were 50,000 people actually read it on the first day. Have you had much reaction to what were some pretty outspoken opinions?
Alec, at the end of the day, no matter where you are in the hierarchy in the government, if you're aware of wrongdoing, it has to be dealt with. And unfortunately, for a number of years, even those that are now seen as being on the right side of the fence in government, they were on the wrong side of the fence and they didn't do anything about it. Now, the legal obligations imposed are quite clear. And it's not as if there was no warnings given. We first opened a docket against Dudu Mayeni in March 2015. And we made it clear that, in our opinion, she was running the airline into the ground. We opened another docket in January 2016. Now, in July 2016, when Pravin Gordhan gave the presentation at an Ernst & Young business breakfast, the question was put solidly to him, what are you doing about stopping the rot at South African Airways? And the answer was nothing more than a fob-off answer. And as I said, this woman carried on for a further 16 months in office and brought that airline to its knees. Now, the economics of running an airline are not the sort of thing that should be entrusted to somebody that's best qualified to teach primary school children. And I think that's the problem from the get-go, that people were appointed to run the airline and then she dissipated or got rid of some of the key talent that South African Airways had built up over a number of years. So you're left with this airline being hollowed out, if you like, of good quality skills because the people weren't prepared to sing and dance to the tune of Dudu Mayeni. And I think now the chickens have come home to roost and the airline is on its knees. But clearly the solution has to be restructure the airline, get it up and running in a profitable manner, and then grow it organically, grow it when the time is right in the marketplace. Bring it back to basics, get the number of staff down, get equipment levels down, and start not start again, but start with a reduced market.
Paul O'Sullivan talking to us from far away. Lovely as always to have that conversation with him, and useful insights there on, well, an alternative proposal to South African Airways. Although I must admit, David, we're getting quite a lot of feedback from the BizNews community, including some captains of South African Airways, one of whom actually went on the record to say, okay, we know that it's not working in its current form, but don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are alternatives.
That's what the whole business rescue exercise was supposed to be, rescue the business. And, you know, they've let it down, obviously. They're so short of money at the moment, so desperate that they can't, you know, afford to take the next step. And we've been hit where, obviously now by this COVID-19, where there's no travel at all, so it's just exacerbated the situation. But I agree, don't let this die. You know, I'm not I understand bad business, but this has got such a strong brand name, and it's got so many. It's like closing Coca-Cola, you know, because the brand is strong enough to stand on its own. You just need to refinance it as well. And we did have that technical excellence. We did have the good people. They're still around somewhere. You'll find it. They're working for all the other airlines now. You know, bring them home.
Well, not only working for all the other airlines, many are still working at South African Airways, that's for sure. But Gigi, the point you were making about the ecosystem, and David referred to it as well, just elaborate a little bit, because this is an incredibly complex world that we live in, and you've got a unique insight for a business analyst into what's going on in the informal sector. So take us through your argument of unemployment is not 29%, it's actually 12%. And that those people, the difference is 17% of our population are actually employed in different ways. And that we haven't really taken that into account in this whole lockdown.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think in short, if you just look at the wholesale sector as an example, something like brands like Unilever, Tiger Brands, Pioneer, etc., you'll find anything from 60 to 80% of their turnover goes through the wholesale channel. So where's that going? That's going to spaza shops and other township businesses, hair salons. If you look at the city at Joburg Market as an example, something like 70% of their produce is going to informal traders and township kind of gorta outlets and food outlets. You know, just the potato sales. I spoke about the agent at the city, at Joburg City Market, who said they lost 30% of their turnover immediately that the spaza shops were, and the vegetable traders were not allowed to trade. So that just gives you an idea, just a few, and I can carry on ad nauseum, but there's a whole bunch of different sectors where you know, you realize suddenly that the massive benefit of that sector. Then people say, well, you know, they don't pay tax. Well, first of all, they pay VAT, and they don't claim VAT, so they're net payers of VAT, you know. So they're paying on all their purchases, they're paying VAT. So, you know, there's a huge benefit to the economy on that. Unilever is hopefully paying their tax, and they're paying that tax on turnover that they have generated by selling to this informal sector. So you can't look at it simplistically and just say, well, that old lady on the street corner is not paying her tax. Well, generally, she's below the tax bracket, number one. Number two, by creating this business, she's creating a turnover from the Tigers of the world and so on. The next thing is that they are they're not a drag on the economy because they are now supporting themselves and not standing in an unemployment queue or stealing or begging or whatever it might be. So we need to consider that. So if you look at this informal economy, the measures are, we don't have enough information about it. There's not enough data about it. If you just take the drop in business across the formal retailers, the wholesalers, and so on, at the moment, based on lockdown, it will suddenly give you a sense of what scale of turnover is being generated by this informal economy. So, and how does it work? To an extent, there is massive networks and interconnectedness between these. So what we see in households, for instance, is that you'll find a household of, call it 3, 4, 5 people, and those people, if you ask them what do they make a living from, they will say from a social grant of 700 Rand, 2 kids, you get 350 Rand a child, call it 700 Rand. And when you dig deeper in the work that I've done, you find that they're also renting out a back room. There's a 30 billion Rand income coming to township households from backroom rental. They're renting out a back room. They are doing laundry for someone who works at SAA, as an example. They will be selling snacks at the local school to the school kids, and so on and so forth. So you suddenly look at a household, and that household that theoretically is living off 700 Rand a month is actually earning around 10,000 Rand a month from multiple other sources. So if we look at that, suddenly we realize the kind of interconnectedness, I guess, of the economy and the extent to which formal income supplement informal incomes, informal income supplement the opportunity that's not created by formal incomes. And the key part of this is that to many ways, the formal economy is not capitalizing on this. So, you know, what is the benefit of bringing in informal businesses into a net where you, you know, banks can lend their money, where government can extract tax from them, municipalities can gain rent from these type of outlets. And because we're not bringing it into the total ecosystem, we're losing out to a large extent in terms of that. And you know, the crazy thing is, if you go to downtown Randburg or even at Sandton, I guess, you'll see a poster on the wall that says, you know, free abortion. You'll see another poster that says penis enlargement. You'll see another one that'll say find lost lovers. And then you'll find one on the wall that says get a loan. And it'll say condition to the blacklist, not important. Bring 3 months pay slips and 3 months bank statements. And that's the reality, is that we're only catering to the people who have a pay slip. And we're ignoring the fact that there's this massive other part of our economy. We're looking just at the people with pay slips in that formal sector, both for help and for opportunity.
David, it's a very interesting point, this, because we believe that things are going to be different after COVID-19, after the lockdown, when we come out of it again. Surely there's a relook required now on this huge sector that Gigi's mentioned, which doesn't even rate a mention.
You know, it's a much broader argument, I think, in developing countries. The way that we measure GDP is old-fashioned, exactly as Gigi has been exposing that. And I agree with it. I buy that argument. You know, I'm fully behind it, because you can actually see it unwinding on every street corner. And the fact that we're not measuring it in Unilever's, or not trying to extrapolate it in Unilever's numbers or even any other retailer or wholesaler. But it goes further than that. I think the whole way that we measure GDP globally, I think, is outdated. You know, this goes back, I don't know, 100 odd years, where you've got a tech economy. We're not able to actually measure the production that's being created by various tech apps and so on. So I'm happy to buy it. And I mean, we can see that. The problem is that we're not seeing it in the taxes, or we are seeing it in the taxes. Maybe it's already there in terms of that. But I think there's a lot of other stuff that is not measured. And to be honest, I don't think we should start applying that to a lot of those areas like the backroom rental and that. I think it's going to kill that economy and make it difficult, and it'll go underground. But, I'm fully happy accepting this argument that unemployment is far lower than we tend to measure in the formal, stats.
During the Easter weekend, I had a conversation with Ian Ambler, who is the co-owner of a company called Clifford Engineering, and it was a fascinating interview. It went pretty viral. Many people were interested in it, not least because To get a respirator nowadays, it's like in the Business for South Africa, a press conference that I attended a couple of weeks ago, Stavros Nicolaou from Aspen said it was like trying to hunt a dodo. They're so rare. And with Ian's company, with Clifford Engineering, they actually produced one, which many of them are still in use, but they stopped producing them in 2003 because of corruption. Of course, with what's happening now, Ian's dusting off the blueprints. He said he was prepared to give those blueprints to anybody else. They would like to start producing them again. And I thought it'd be a good idea to bring him on to the show today. And you guys can also ping a few questions at him just to find out how things have developed. Ian, I hope you can hear us now. Can you just bring us up to date with what the response has been to the interview that we had?
Sure, Alec. The response was remarkable. Actually, we've had an incredible amount of assistance and goodwill. You know, we've had assistance from companies like Rapid 3D who have printed 3D printed parts for us, you know, overnight and in incredibly short time frames. Other companies we work around here, Cosmos Engineering, who've made parts for us and refused to let us invoice for them. You know, they've literally made them for nothing. It's been an incredibly collaborative effort. And it's been very gratifying to see. It kind of restores your faith in human nature when you see this kind of thing. What was interesting, you know, our biggest delay, believe it or not, ended up being the parts stuck in customs in Johannesburg at OR Tambo. And we lost a whole week on that, believe it or not, which was a tragedy. But it was impressive to see, you know, how people helped us. We had ANC politicians rolling up their sleeves to help us. We had Nigel Ward, the vice president of Toyota South Africa, assisting us himself, you know, and he really got stuff out of customs for us in record time, together with a company he uses for all their own clearing. So it's been extremely humbling, actually, and gratifying to see how everyone has rolled up their sleeves to assist us. And we got our updated ventilator model running on Saturday afternoon, and it's working beautifully. If the line is clear, you may hear it breathing behind me in the background, but it's running very nicely. We are incredibly happy that it's up and running. We thought we would be late. We could have been done a week earlier if it wasn't for the customs delays, but the bottom line is it's up and running, working, and doing what it's supposed to do. We're very pleased with it.
Now, the critical part about that is the whether the machine will actually work on sick people. I did pose again at that press conference. I actually asked one of Gigi's questions and one of your questions, and the question there was a lot of interest in the respirator, but it was also made that it has to be technically correct. You can't just put any bellows into someone's lungs and expect that they're going to be able to be respirated. Just take us through the not the technicals of it, but the development of it which makes you confident that this is a solution. Oh, and we can hear it in the background, by the way.
Okay, good. Look, Alec, obviously it's a machine that you know, is connected to a human being. You've got to use the best possible components. We don't just use normal pneumatic valves or pressure transducers or anything like that. We buy medical rated components. So they are completely clean. There's no pneumatic grease inside them or anything like that. The air has to be completely filtered and clean. The solenoid valves that we use, you need to make sure that they cannot create, there's no possibility of a spark because oxygen is highly combustible and it can explode, pure oxygen. So we obviously take care of all of those details, but you know, if we hadn't built these things before, Alec, and supplied to hospitals and worked with various doctors and hospitals, anesthetists, you know, we wouldn't have a chance in doing this quickly. But the fact of the matter is, we did this for many years. So that, you know, that gave us a big head start. We know what components to use. We know how to do the control. We have not changed the design. It's the same proven design. All we did was update the components in it, particularly the electronic components, so that they are present-day components that you can buy off the shelf.
last we spoke, you were having problems actually getting through to the right people at the Department of Trade and Industry and the IDC. Any progress there?
Alec, yes, the IDC have been very helpful, and we appreciate that. There's a lot of people there rolling up their sleeves and working extremely hard, and I really do respect that. You know, we had the CEO of the IDC call us personally and send us an email or two, and a number of his staff assisting us. So, you know, we appreciate that very much. The IDC, and I'm talking unofficially here, it looks like they will move forward with a simpler design than ours. It's basically what we call a CPAP ventilator, CPAP standing for continuous positive airway pressure. And without going into too much detail, ours will do the same function, but ours is also has additional functions which enable it to be used as an ICU ventilator, an intensive care unit ventilator. So it will do the simple functions, but it will do a lot more. But, and this is where the big but comes in, it's not a complicated device. Most ICU ventilators are not simple to use, not at all. Our one we developed 20-odd years ago was specifically developed to be a full ICU ventilator, which built for African conditions and made to be very simple to use. And it really is very simple to use. So, you know, it will cover the CPAP functions. That's the absolute minimum, but it will cover a lot more than that. Now, in my opinion, I understand why the IDC appear to be concentrating on a much simpler CPAP type unit. It does reduce the complexity, and I think they're sort of trying to to follow the 80-20 principle, where they kind of covering the 80% or 70% need rather than the 100% need. But I do believe that there's a definite requirement for slightly more detailed ventilators that aren't, and I use the word detailed as opposed to complicated. Ours can be used not just as a constant pressure device or CPAP device, but as an active breathing device that will assist the patient with each intake of breath, and it will be automatically timed. It is automatically timed to work with his breathing. In other words, his breathing triggers the assistance that the machine provides. It doesn't just force him to take a certain number of breaths per minute, which could actually do more harm than good in a COVID-19 patient.
So what's next, Ian? How many of these ventilators are you going to be able to produce for the country?
Alec, look, you asked me that in our last interview, and I said it's a chicken and egg question, and it really is. If we understand that if there's an enormous demand, we can't possibly produce enough. At the moment, we're not being asked to produce any directly for South Africa at all. In fact, most of the interest, we've had enormous interest, most of it from outside our borders, strangely enough. But how many we can produce really depends on how many we get orders for. We're a company that works with a large number of subcontractors that we've been using for many years and suppliers. And we will continue to use those, and we've been talking with many local companies who've contacted us to assist with making additional components where we can't keep up with our own supply chain. We've had people like Nigel Ward, the vice president of Toyota, phoning up and saying, look, he's completely ready to assist us with whatever we need to ramp this thing up and go into serious production volumes. And, you know, that's Toyota understand that kind of thing better than we do. And we would certainly take full advantage of a kind offer like that.
But, yeah, here we have people saying that respirators are rarer than dodos, and you saying you'd like to make them. Where's the gap? Where's the disconnect?
Look, Alec, there's the disconnect is we haven't had anyone yet from the South African government or Department of Trade and Industry or IDC or anyone like that saying, guys, we want you to make, you know, 500 of these or 5,000 of these or anything like that. That really is the disconnect. They are going through a process, and we're waiting to hear what comes of it. We made the decision 3 weeks ago, Alec, that we weren't going to wait for any more response or comeback, or, you know, we've still heard nothing official. So I'm glad we didn't wait. We've decided to go ahead. And in the last 3 weeks, we've used that time to make our first working unit, and it's working really nicely. But the bottom line is we've done that off our own backs. We made that decision on our own, and we got on with it on our own, and we haven't had any financial assistance thus far, which is a pity. As I said last time, Alec, you know, we're seeing this project we're engaged in as a double-edged sword. There's the altruistic side of it, where we obviously want to do the right thing for our country and our people and build ventilators. There's a desperate need for them. And the other side of it is from a more typical business decision. We need to keep our company moving, and we need to be able to pay our employees so they can pay they can put food on the table for their employees. And we're chasing all available options right now. Would you prefer to make them for South Africa rather than overseas? Yes, we would.
If you got an order today from the States for 500, how long would it take you to produce them?
Alec, if we got an order today for 500, I think we could make them easily within a month. If, and this is the big if, we need a hotline or a speed dial number to someone in government or in SARS or the IDC or whatever who can get us things through customs. We cannot sit waiting for things to clear in customs for a week. You know, our most critical components were items that hit customs on Tuesday, the week before last, and we only got them out on Tuesday last week after the Easter weekend. And I understand that it was particularly problematic during the lockdown and the Easter weekend, but those are the things that kill us. And if we can have assistance with that kind of thing, it will make an enormous difference to how fast we can make these things.
David, we've seen that in many areas, mountains have been moved by government in this crisis, in this COVID-19 crisis. You would think that if respirators are such a desperately required piece of equipment, in which they're looking all over the world to try and source them, you got a homegrown solution that can produce hundreds within a month.
They would open it up. I hope Ian's still listening, because I did a fascinating interview this morning with Philips. You know, their results came out, which were very good, and they were talking about respirators. And there's a lot of sophistication as well. I would assume that they're at the top end, because they were talking about the complications of the software, you know, which obviously monitors the way you're breathing and so on. But and he was saying, the CEO was saying, just how they're working, you know, three shifts a day, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to get these what he called a precision diagnostic equipment, you know, through to the users. The question I want to ask Ian is, what does it cost? What does a respirator cost? You know, of his making, what are we talking about in terms of cost? And also, how do they compare, say, to someone like Philips? And I'm not questioning the quality that Ian's, just simply to try and gauge where we are in the global, in the global market.
Yeah, look, the cost is a difficult one to answer, because it depends on how much sophistication you want in the unit. You know, if you wanted a really simple CPAP-only unit, that's a big difference in price to the one. Ours will do that, and it will also do all the ICU functionality. But my opinion is we should build these things all the same with all of that functionality, because our unit is particularly simple. In terms of pricing, you know, we have not got that 100% battened down yet, because we are still looking at the cost of some of the components and transport, et cetera, et cetera. But we have used slightly more expensive components in the thing. You know, for example, the PLC, the programmable logic controller, is a Siemens unit. It's made in Germany. It comes from Germany, but they're incredibly reliable. That's what we put our software into. There are cheaper ways of doing it, but that unit is completely reliable. It's completely proven. There's hundreds of them available off the shelf. You could argue that it's an overkill for what it is doing, but it's in the current circumstances where delivery is critical, it's a no-brainer to use an item like that. So the cost of ours compared with a Philips ICU ventilator, it's enormously cheaper. In rough numbers, depending on the spec of the machine, it's going to be somewhere around $8,000 or something like that. But again, don't quote me on that because these are estimates at this stage.
We can't not quote you because you're actually on our program. Yeah.
Well, then you caught me, Alex. So we're doing this live.
We're not doing it live, but it's recorded as live. But still around $8,000. Okay. Gigi, from your perspective, do you have any thoughts for Ian?
Sure. It sounds like a completely different world.
But think about Msinga.
Well, Msinga, Tugela Ferry Hospital in Msinga has the dubious distinction of being the center of TB, the drug-resistant TB, and has probably the highest number of cases of drug-resistant TB. So I think when coronavirus arrives there, it's going to be the one that's got Chuck Norris imprinted on it, you know. So they're very likely going to need them more desperately than anything else. I think, you know, I mean, my feeling is that to a large extent, and this is my frustration with government around the informal sector, among other things, is that the ability to move is just so slow, and you know, hence the lack of orders. And I think this is the tragedy, is that when you have got a epidemic like we have now, you need agility and speed of movement, and in some ways drop a lot of the bureaucratic barriers. And tragically, this is not happening.
It's interesting that in certain areas it is happening. There are certain things that have been going through very rapidly, but in a case like this, as you've mentioned, not so easy. Ian, I guess you've got to start moving mountains yourself somehow.
Yes, and we're doing that, Alec. You know, we're moving ahead as best we can, and we have a number of other interested parties who we're talking to, which is not quite the way we've expected it to go. But obviously, we're a business. We've got to make business decisions for the best of ourselves and our employees and their families. But just to highlight, to pick up on something Gigi Alcock said there, you know, he mentioned small companies, speed and agility. And Alec, I want to pick up on that. I said the same thing in my interview to you 2 weeks ago, that I thought in a way a company like ours there's an irony here that a company like ours gets overlooked because we are small. And, but in a situation like this, you know, we've shown that in 3 weeks we've built a working ventilator. We've got the drawings done. It's all modeled. It's completely done. We've got a complete bill of materials, and it is working. It is physically running. It's operating. It's pumping mechanical lungs up and down. And tomorrow we'll test it further with the doctors. So in 3 weeks we've done that. And in fact we could have done it in 2 weeks because we lost a full 7 days with the most critical components sitting in customs. And that's where I think, you know, if you use a small agile company and you put them together with the might of the DTIs and the
IDC,
mm-hmm. IDC, and you know, and those guys assist us with the things, the logistics, like getting stuff through customs and all the rest of it, and assisting with buying power, etc. You do the two together, it's amazing what can be achieved. You know, I'm not pretending that we are, our business is, you know, particularly unique or it's a one in a million or anything like that. We were very fortunate in that we have made these things before. So, you know, let's take advantage of that. They're proven, it's developed, it works. Let's take advantage of that and get on with it. To me, it makes perfect sense. And as I said many times, we are completely happy to work as collaboratively as possible. We really are.
Ian Ambler from the Pietermaritzburg company Clifford Engineering. David, we have seen government changing things and making differences. It does appear as though it can move very rapidly when it needs to, and yet something's falling off the table here with respirators, which Tugela Ferry, for instance, could do with half a dozen tomorrow.
But Alec, it's, you know, the private sector in South Africa has always held its head up high. You know, we've always come through when we've needed to. I've got great respect for South African businessmen and their ability to be creative and, you know, in difficult circumstances, whether it's from the mining sector to the engineering to doctors to lawyers, you name it. What is the holdup now is government, you know, and they've got to play the game as well, and they've got to come to the party. I mean, Ian sounds a very impressive man, and it's obvious that he runs a, you know, super business. So, and if he can benefit from it, even if it's not from a South African point of view, which is sad, well, maybe we've just opened up a whole new industry for South African business on the export side. But yeah, you're right. You know, South Africa, we've got to get the right people in government to do the right kind of things. And there's got to be a department that, that recognizes these issues. And it applies to the same argument we had with SAA, Alec. You know, it wasn't the technical issues. It wasn't, technically we've been there. We've delivered the service. What did let us down was the government interference and incompetence in actually running the business.
Ian's company, incidentally, exports 95% of the machines it makes. This is not respirators. They've just gone back into that. 95% of the machines it makes into the United States, into the most sophisticated first world company. So there's nothing wrong with their engineering. That probably puts that idea to rest. Just to look at the post COVID-19 economy. We're seeing the country opening up in 2 weeks' time. On the formal side of the economy, how are you expecting the opening up to occur, and how long might it take for us to get back to a semblance of normality?
I think it's going to take some time. I think we've got to build up confidence. I think from what Gigi says, you know, obviously the informal sector is going to get there a lot faster than maybe the formal sector. But we have to start with mines and factories first. We have to start with big business and get certainly the mining side of the economy operating. You know, the other side of it, the entertainment side, the restaurants and that can come later, as hard as it is on that. But even there, we can start making some kind of concessions on that. But I think the first step is definitely to get big business working again and to get the mines producing. So, you know, that's the side that I'd like to see happening. Yes, commodity prices are still under pressure, but we've got to get back to work there. And the longer we leave it, the more it's going to leave its scars.
And the restructuring that everybody's talking about now, the lessons that we would have learned in the last or in this 5-week lockdown?
Well, I hope that has some impact, you know, and I hope we can get back without ideology, you know, proving another stumbling block. And I've never been a political animal. I've always believed, as we've heard with Ian and Clifford Engineering, and said, you know, the excellence is there. Do whatever you can to bring out the excellence in this economy. And Alec, we've had so much experience of this in the many, many years that we've been in business. And I just hope that we resurrect a lot of those businesses and resurrect that spirit, you know, that has got us through so many issues in the past.
Gigi, from your side, the unlocking of the informal sector, it's surely, well, 10, 11 days to go until that occurs.
So I quoted in one of the articles I wrote a guy who created Idea Lab, and he said, what was the most important thing for a startup business to be successful? And it came down to one thing. It was about timing. And I just think that, don't waste a good crisis. So I think that there's huge opportunities represented by this, and particularly, you know, I think, as I said earlier, everyone's looking at the lockdown. We should be looking. The reality is that we're going to have, for the next 6 months, we are going to continue to have post-lockdown restrictions and certainly the impact, if not longer, but let's just call it 6 to 8 months. And in my mind, the opportunities from both a government perspective, so for instance, they should be actually bringing us into the loop at the moment in terms of saying, this is how we want to, or thinking of, or please give us ideas of how we should unlock the system, the economy, at the same time not bringing any risk, health risk, or whatever it might be. And I think that it's a real mistake that they kind of go, da-da, here we go, and the next step, We should be using these 2 weeks to start planning for a post-lockdown. I don't believe they're going to extend the lockdown after the end of April. I just think that the economy won't be able to absorb it. Certainly the informal economy will not be able to absorb it, and we'll just have large-scale social unrest. So let's assume that, my belief is that they're going to start opening up schools and smaller businesses and et cetera. So But we should be preparing for that and as a country, number one. Number two, I just think from a business perspective, there are massive opportunities. I mean, I just wrote about in an article I think you had this morning about the opportunities in the financial services sector. You know, we're wanting to get social grants, not have people queuing up at malls and at ATMs. What are the opportunities that we should be looking at to roll out in the next 6 months to be able to alleviate that opportunity? And so on, you know, delivery mechanisms, distribution models in that space. I think there's massive opportunities that we should be looking at, which will both help the informal sector, but also creating business opportunities for other businesses outside of that informal sector. And let's look at the economy differently, and let's look at solutions to that space differently. Because we have no choice right now, so it forces us, in essence, to sharpen our pencils.
David, given that, it might sound as though it's idealistic, but in a good crisis, nothing is idealistic because you can reassess everything. Would you remain invested in South African shares, or are you going to be cautious about some?
I'm still very cautious. I'm very cautious about how long this is going to take to really turn around. I think, you know, when it comes to managing other people's money, which I do, you're a risk manager. You know, you can't be, with my own money, I can do what I like, but with other people's money, you've got to make sure that you're in the right kind of companies and you're protecting it. And I think against the backdrop that we've seen here, things are still very, very tight. So, you've got to separate what I do from that. And I still believe that, you know, I was listening to Philips this morning, to the CEO. I mean, it's a remarkable business based in Holland. What they're doing, the kind of machines they're doing, how hard they're working, where technology is taking over. You know, those are the kind of investments that we have to make to protect people's money. But it doesn't mean, you know, you've got to separate the two from a different point of view. You know, we're still working to make South Africa work, and we'll do anything to help along those kind of lines. And, you know, hence we're on the program, and, you know, hence we're making comments, and hence we're doing webcasts and writing articles and doing that to help people through this very, very difficult time.
This has been Rational Radio. We'll be back again, same time, same place, next week. To our in virtual studio guests, David Shapiro and DG Alcock, thanks so much. I'm Alec Hogg. Until the next time, cheerio.